Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer. This week we're focusing on Seven Dirty Words and George Carlin. He was the man who gave the monologue about those words, and Pacifica was the network that broadcast his monologue. This resulted, back in 1978, in stricter rules around language and decency on the airwaves, and is a battle that still goes on today. Just think of Nipplegate and Janet Jackson. In this half hour, we will hear from George Carlin himself, in excerpts from two wonderful interviews he gave, one in 1970, before his Filthy Words monologue was broadcast on WBAI, and the other was conducted by Larry Binsky at KPFA in June of 1997, nearly 30 years after. Together, they provide a time-lapse view of one of the more controversial and brilliant comedians this country has. This interview was called Comedian in Transition and was conducted by Alan Farley at the Playboy Club in San Francisco in December 1970. It originally aired on KPFA in February of that year.
Maybe this is a corny question, but are there any comedians who have influenced you or who were people you really dug when you were young?
And I have like different sets of them. My first set of comedian that I liked and influenced me, I think, were like Danny Kaye in the movies, Spike Jones on records, the Marx Brothers in the movies, then Martin and Lewis. Now that starts a new era of, I was a little older, Martin and Lewis, and then that leads into like Ernie Kovacs, Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah.
And then that leads into Jonathan Winters, Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Lord Buckley. There are a lot of guys that don't do especially inventive or great original comedy that I like because they make me laugh, too. You know, I mean, I kind of tend to want to hear new things and guys that are really doing something different and saying something. But I'm also an ordinary human being who laughs at funny things when a good comic gets on. So there are guys like that who do it to me, you know. But Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul were very influential early on when I had a partner, Jack Burns, who later went with Avery Schreiber.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Well, Jack and I had a team, and Mort helped get us started, and Lenny helped us. Lenny got us our first agency contract. I used to do an impression of Lenny and Mort in the act 10 years ago. Mm. I did my Lenny and Mort, and they came in to see it, and so they helped us a little. And I kind of tried to stay in touch with Lenny and knew him a little bit. I knew his mother a little better, I think. Sally, she's funny. And they always had a strong influence. I always felt that was eventually what I'd like to do, even while I was detoured into the other thing, and I was trying to find out and test the limits and see how much TV would let me do, where they'd let me go, would they give me my show. Now I've come around to where I can at least talk about some of the same subjects Mort and Lenny talked about, and I'd love to accomplish some of the things that Lenny set out to accomplish, that is, to make people more comfortable with themselves. That's really all it is.
I think in a way a lot of that has happened.
Oh, indeed, it's such a shame that Lenny didn't just arrive at this period now, the 68, 69, 70.
Certainly in San Francisco, from what I've seen, at least there's not the taboo about words and
right.
language, and people don't get arrested for saying things.
Right.
Like he did. Did you grow up in New York? Are you from
there? Upper West Side of Manhattan, around Harlem, Columbia University, Juilliard. Good influences, good childhood vibes, a lot of good people kind of people, a lot of strong funk. And we were into some of the agriculture situation, which is only recently, I was a teenager in 52. Let's see, in 52 I was 15 years old. And I had smoked grass 2 years before that. So that what I'm trying to say to you is that it was a neighborhood that, even though it was that long ago, the neighborhood was into grass. I'm happy to say.
And where did you
begin? Oh, I quit high school. Quit high school at 17. I wanted to be an actor, comedian, imitator. I didn't know what. I knew that disc jockeying could help me get there. My mother had got me a tape recorder, and I worked with it a lot. And I really dug production and speaking, you know. And I quit high school so that I could, again, the same kind of reasons that you hear about today, man. It was irrelevant. It was boring, and I was beyond much of the work. And there was had nothing to do with the world I was going into. And so I left, man. And I went in the Air Force, figuring when I got out. At that time, of course, you didn't shirk your draft thing yet. Unfortunately, that wasn't part of the thinking of young people at that time. To me, what I was doing was getting my Air Force over so they wouldn't draft me at 22. That was the problem in New York. They had so many cats that you didn't get drafted until 22 or 3, right when you were getting it on. So I wanted to do it up and get it over with, and I went in the Air Force. My mother signed me, and instead of having to wait till I got out to go on the GI Bill for disc jockey school. I found a station while I was in that let me work down in Louisiana. I worked off base at a number one top 40 station, so I was 18 when I started my jock career, and I still stayed 2 years in the Air Force. So I got a lot done at the same time. When I got out, I was 20, and I had 2 years in radio, and I had my service obligation out of the way, as we called it. It's such a funny phrase, my service obligation. Right, anyway. And then the disc jockeying was for 4 years, and that led to meeting a guy in radio, Jack Burns, funny cat, and we were funny together, so we said, hey, let's do a team. And we did that for 2 years. And then I became a single in 62 at the Gator Horn.
I don't know, what do you think is the biggest problem in America? Is that an unfair question?
I guess it's fair. The biggest problem is values. That's all. The newer kind of human beings that are being born during this technological rush are indeed newer types of human beings, and their values are different, and there's a real terrible clash because so many people are still alive. In other words, the change came so quickly in technology and in what has happened to the planet and the people that there are now at the same time alive people with vast different experiences. It used to be many lifetimes would go by before a father and son had different experiences. Now it's an incredibly different experience, a father and a son and a son and a son within 40 years. Like, it's fantastic. So the big problem is the values that are being threatened by that, and many of them should be, obviously. and then there are some that probably shouldn't disappear altogether. The big problem is deciding which ones we want to retain, I think.
What kind of material about Nixon do you use in your act?
I must say that as far as Nixon himself is concerned, I haven't really gotten in to him. It's more been things about things about the Vietnam shtick in general, and then I refer to him insofar as he is he's now the guy who has to, you know, do the thing. The things I've developed the most up to now, which are new and which are kind of, what are we talking about, this kind of comedy? Social satire, social commentary, whatever, are a drug rap, a thing about values and conspicuous consumption concerning what we sell in novelty stores. We sell fake vomit and we sell little pieces of dog crap, and there are people who have to walk by that don't have enough food that day, you know, and there's a long thing about it, and how do you sell and buy dog crap, and some of the theory that must go into it. And there is stuff about hair, clay, Vietnam. You heard some of these things tonight, somewhat edited in some cases, because these, you know, the folks here don't really, I don't know whether it is whether they don't understand or don't like, but there are certain things that I'm just best avoiding while I'm here.
What about films?
Yeah, I'd like to write them.
Have you done, that's another question.
Have you written for? No, I haven't done any writing outside of my own material, but I have a film I'm writing now. I hope someone will like it and make it sometime, you know, when I finish it. It's not a thing I can do every day because I'm trying to get this other thing working. But when I can, I work on it. I'd like to do that eventually, write a film, a play, a couple of films, a book that can turn into a film. I've really found out in the last 2 years that the thing I enjoy most is writing these ideas out. Delivering them from a stage is second to that. It's nice to be able to deliver your own material, but it's so much better now, I've found, to be able to sit and write it. The thing I want most is to say how I feel, not so much out loud as just to have it written out. And I don't know, I'm 33. If I could do my comedy thing for 5 or 6 or 7 more years and really feel I had gotten a lot of that out of my system on stage and everything, then I could really concentrate on writing and have a career at that. And it's the most independent thing you can do it anywhere in the world, and that's what I love about it. And those would be my general plans. I really do want to try this concert thing and try to establish that reputation and do it for several years and really just be able to do it for nice audiences and groovy, nice heads and big audiences, you know. But I know I'll tire of that, and then I think the answer will be writing only.
I think you've got a good future in that,
groovy.
In that line.
Thank you. Yeah, I got to just keep working. But it's fun work, you know, that's the nice thing. What's your job? Oh, thinking up funny stuff. What a great job! So I'm at least happy in that, you know, and then as I get to say it, crazy.
I hope that you get a chance to come back to San Francisco. Maybe you can, you know, and have a place where you can say it and are received well.
Good. Well, thank you. I'll be looking forward to it. It's certainly one place that I won't want to miss, right?
That was Alan Farley interviewing George Carlin in 1970 at the Playboy Club in San Francisco.
George Carlin, you're a very unusual guest for Pacifica Radio. You're probably the only person in the United States that we don't have to give the Carlin warning to about which words you can't say on this program.
Yes.
Because it's named after you.
Larry Binsky of KPFA interviewing George Carlin on June 4th, 1997.
You've done many things, and I'll do the classic radio talk show host research. I'll read the flap copy of your book here. You've had 18, it says, hit comedy albums, won 2 Grammys and 2 Cable Ace Awards, had your own television sitcom, appeared in 9 movies, 9 solo HBO stand-up comedy specials. In the book you say you work about 100 nights a year in various clubs.
No, theaters and concert halls.
I'm very
territorial about that.
Theaters and concert halls. Very busy life, but this is your first book.
Yes.
There's much we could talk about in your book, page after page of various wisdoms. And if I write about this book, which I may well do, because I really was quite entertained, amused, and enthralled by reading Brain Droppings by George Carlin, several themes came through to me very clearly. One is your love of language and the contradictions inherent in human utterance.
Yes.
And I know you're a high school dropout. You don't have a PhD in linguistics or anything like that. To what do you attribute your fascination with the intellectual constructs of language and the ironies and contradictions in how we communicate through language?
Well, thank you for the wonderful description of that. I mean, I'm sort of complimented, and at the same time, I'm gathering information on how to describe myself. I think more things are genetic than we have reason to suspect even at this time. And my grandfather, who was a policeman in New York City at the turn of the century, the family legend has it that he, during his adult years, wrote out in longhand the works of Shakespeare because of the joy it gave him. And he too was more or less self-educated, as they say. My mother was careful to lead me to the dictionary whenever possible, would point out interesting figures of speech when she, even in a newspaper, when she came across an interesting thing in a column or some turn of phrase that she thought was stunning or marvelous, she would show me and talk about it. My father, whom I didn't know, was a public speaker and an advertising salesman, the national ad manager of the New York Sun, and a raconteur, a great storyteller, and won the Dale Carnegie National Public Speaking Contest in 1935 against 800 other people with his subject, The Power of Mental Demand. So you don't lick it off the rocks, as they say in
and
Ireland.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
That's right, as the twig is bent, or something in the middle of all that. So a lot of it is genetic. And then I have an analytical and critical side to my nature, I think, that lends itself to wanting to point out other people's errors or their weaknesses in language.
But do you remember as a child being the type of kid that everybody would stop and listen to, where you were always able to make your family and your friends laugh?
Two things. Yes, the answer is yes. I was a kid in the you know, we had hundreds and hundreds of kids in our neighborhood. And I mean, you know, New York, the overlapping streets and blocks and neighborhoods, and the overlapping age groups of you. You know, your bigger brother would hang around with my bigger brother, and our younger brothers hung around together, but we never saw each other. So I came from that kind of a neighborhood. And anytime we got caught, anytime 3 or 4 of us were together and we were in trouble and the police were on the way or the guard at the Columbia University was about to apprehend us, let Georgie do the talking. Let Georgie, you do the talking. Georgie will get us out of this. So I was that guy. And secondly, my mother taught me early that I was kind of cute and clever and funny, that I could do imitations. She taught me to imitate Mae West, whom I'd never seen.
Oh, let's hear that now. Come on.
Come up. I mean, it's absurd. It was much cuter at 4, believe me. But it was the standard line, why don't you come up and see me sometime? But the hand on the hip was part of the deal. But I'd never heard her. And here's a guy doing impressions of a person he hadn't ever seen or heard. So when I got the laughs, I realized, I think there's an attraction, you know, when you're a kid, and especially slightly lonely, getting the attention and approval of adults is very important. And for it to come so naturally, to just flow out of who I was attractive. And I think those kind of things just lead you in that direction because it's rewarding. It's like Pavlov.
But you come from the last generation. You, as you say in the book now, I'm not revealing any secrets here. You're 60 years old. Mm-hmm. You come from the last generation whose imaginations and whose impressions of the world were not formed from a little black and white or color screen in your home. You had to go to read real people. You didn't have TV when you grew up.
No, radio. I got in on the ground floor of TV, but I was already in my teens and I was out in the streets a lot. So I got a taste of it, but I was mostly a child of radio and the golden age of radio, as they call it. And, I was alone at home a lot because my mother worked. My father had been asked to leave much earlier. He couldn't metabolize ethanol successfully.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
So he was gone. But that's too bad because he was a bright guy, but he was a bit of a bully. So my mother raised us on a good advertising woman's salary for the 1940s, which was impressive then and still is. And so I was alone a lot, and the radio filled those gaps. The radio provided the theater of the mind, as it's called sometimes.
George Carlin, this is the time of year when many eminent sages such as yourself are called upon to address graduation ceremonies.
Oh, yes.
and counsel the hope of the future, as they are called in the great cliche. And I found in your book, your new book, Brain Droppings, one section which I think could kind of serve as a graduation address. I don't know if you intended it as such, but it's called Rules to Live By, and I wonder if you could perhaps share that with our Pacific audience here.
Okay, and I'm new enough at this that I don't know whether to read this as if I'm reading or as if I'm speaking.
Whatever you decide to do, okay. I think will be fine.
It will develop. Rules to Live By. Life is not as difficult as people think. All one needs is a good set of rules. Since it is probably too late for you, here are some guidelines to pass along to your children. 1. Relax and take it easy. Don't get caught up in hollow conceits, such as, quote, doing something with your life, unquote. Such twaddle is outmoded and a sure formula for disappointment. 2. Whatever it is you pursue, try to do it just well enough to remain in the middle third of the field. Keep your thoughts and ideas to yourself and don't ask questions. Remember, the squeaky wheel is the first one to be replaced. 3. Size people up quickly and develop rigid attitudes based on your first impression. If you try to delve deeper and get to, quote, know people, you're asking for trouble. 4. Don't fall for that superstitious nonsense about treating people the way you would like to be treated. It is a transparently narcissistic approach and may be the sign of a weak mind. 5. Spend as much time as you can pleasing and impressing others, even if it makes you unhappy. Pay special attention to shallow manipulators who can do you the most harm. Remember, in the overall scheme, you count for very little. 6. Surround yourself with inferiors and losers. Not only will you look good by comparison, but they will look up to you, and that will make you feel better. 7. Don't buy into the sentimental notion that everyone has shortcomings. It's the surest way of undermining yourself. Remember, the really best people have no defects. If you're not perfect, something is wrong. 8. If by some off chance you do detect a few faults, first...
From the Vault is a weekly series produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.